Maybe you'd never heard of the alt-right group known as the Proud Boys before last fall when they received the ultimate plug from then-President Donald Trump.
I'm willing to do anything. I want to see peace.
Then do it, sir.
Say it.
Do you want to call them? What do you want to call them? Give me a name.
White supremacists and white supremacists and right
Proud Boys, stand back and stand by.
It wasn't entirely clear what the Proud Boys were supposed to be standing by for until January 6th, when the group's members were among those who showed up to take over the Capitol as they had allegedly been planning for weeks. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The Proud Boys' grievances that day were about the certification of Joe Biden as the rightfully elected 46th president of the United States. The group insisted the win had been stolen from Trump, whose rhetoric and actions felt well in line with the Proud Boys' expressions of white male American pride, which sound to many observers like white nationalism. But as threatening as the group seems to many people, it may be less cohesive and less appealing to new recruits than it once was. E.J. Dixon has been reporting on this. She covers culture as a staff writer at Rolling Stone, which published her recent article, The Rise and Fall of the Proud Boys. E.J., welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do we know about who these guys are? What is the size of the Proud Boys membership?
So the Proud Boys are a far-right extremist organization founded in the lead-up to the 2016 election by Gavin McInnes, who is the former co-founder of Vice Media. The name weirdly comes from a deleted song from Aladdin called Proud of Your Boy, which became something of an inside joke on Gavin's show. And in terms of membership, it really varies depending on who you ask. Estimates range from 5,000 to, Enrique Tarrio told me, I think 35,000. So it's really unclear how many members there actually are. But if you talk to any of them, they'll tell you that it started out as something of a fraternity or a drinking club. And whether or not that's true, it depends on who you ask. But over time, the group, as you stated, has irrefutably evolved into an organization with more far-right political leanings.
They have played a role as security providers, I guess, at events for right-wing politicians?
Yeah, sort of self-appointed security providers for right-wing provocateurs or right-wing politicians. That was kind of how they got started out. They have ties to people like Matt Gaetz, Roger Stone, Ann Coulter in the very early days, Milo Yiannopoulos.
And to be clear, they were never trying to operate in secret, right? You mentioned, and I had no idea about this, these guys were selling branded merchandise on Etsy.
Yes, they very much, I remember speaking to a former FBI agent, and who covers far-right extremism, and he said, you know, it's pretty rare for these groups to, you know, be so flagrant in their espousal of, you know, far-right violence. And the Proud Boys, you know, from the very beginning, were extremely open about the fact that they promoted violence. It was used as a recruiting tactic in a lot of ways on social media platforms like YouTube. So they were very much operating out in the open for quite some time.
When you say it was used as a recruiting tool, like when there would be video of the Proud Boys getting in fights with protesters or counter-protesters, that was put up on YouTube to show everybody else how cool, air quotes here, the Proud Boys were?
That's correct. Yeah, these would typically be altercations in cities like Portland between, quote-unquote Antifa, anti-fascist, you know, left-wing protesters and Proud Boys, and they were sort of used as a promotional tool for the organization itself, which ties into the degrees of initiation for members of the group. One of the degrees of initiation is getting into a violent altercation for quote unquote the cause. And the cause is really, they claim to be Western chauvinists or defenders of white male Western culture. And in the early days, this footage of these Proud Boys, you getting into really violent spats with left-wing protesters were sort of used as a recruitment tactic or propaganda to promote that agenda.
Most of the white males in my life do not espouse the same values as the Proud Boys. So can you explain what they mean when they say white male Western culture?
Well, I think there are two different answers to that question. If you asked a Proud Boy, I think that they would tell you that white male Western culture You know, it's not at the expense of other races. You know, they're not racists. They're not, you know, xenophobic. They're just defenders of white male Western culture and white male imperialism and of, you know, all the cultural ideals, you know, the nuclear family and all of the cultural ideals that white men have, you know, created and espoused over the years. Obviously, you know, if you look at the actual language that the Proud Boys use on social media, it's a lot more insidious than that. I mean, I would argue that that is, you know, saying you defend white male Western culture is pretty insidious on face value. But I mean, it's there are a lot of, you know, members of the group who have used racial slurs, transphobic slurs on social media in their writings. You know, they cite, you know, far right white nationalist texts as inspiration. And it's very much intertwined with their ethos, whether or not they publicly admit it.
So Gavin McInnes, the founder of the Proud Boys and a co-founder of Vice, we'll get to that in a minute. But he had read this book by Pat Buchanan called The Death of the West. What is that book all about?
I have not. I am, you know, I'm proud to say I haven't read that book.
Okay.
But by all accounts, you know, it was pretty, it was like pretty crucial to helping to transform his thinking. As early as 2003, he told the New York Times, you know, I love being white and I think it's something to be very proud of. You know, he doesn't want his culture diluted. He was, you know, advocating for closing the borders and letting everyone assimilate to a Western white English speaking way of life. And I remember when I found that quote, it was in a profile on the early days of Vice. I was shocked because he was just openly saying this stuff and nobody was really, you know, calling him out on it or pressing him on this. And there are a lot of people who have followed the trajectory of the Proud Boys being like, how could this happen? How could this quote unquote drinking club evolve into this far right extremist organization? And you look at quotes like that from as early as 2003 and it's like, well, how could you not have predicted this?
We should make sure people know McInnes and Vice parted company, I think, in 2008. But what do we know about his background before then? Like, was he once sort of the kind of person who did journalism like everybody else, or has he always had these unusual extreme views?
He's always been a provocateur. He's always been, you know, a very incendiary person, the type of person who, you know, my generation says things for attention, I guess. There's a really great piece in Vanity Fair, actually, that just came out about the early days of Gavin McInnes as a founder of Vice. And, you know, while he initially started out, you know, he was a vegetarian, he was a feminist, he sort of gravitated towards being, you know, more right wing and more incendiary. And for a while, it was sort of under the guise of being contrarian and hyper ironic. I think in the early 2000s, you know, if you look at the early issues of Vice, you know, you can sort of see this strain of quote unquote hipster racism or ironic racism, where not just Gavin, but, you know, plenty of writers for Vice would say, you know, really outrageous incendiary things. And it would kind of be cloaked under the guise of, you know, this is ironic. Like, we're making fun of the idea of racism. We're not actually racist. I think he was able to sort of get away with promoting these ideas, you know, with using the F word to talk about gay people, you know, saying incredibly transphobic things, incredibly offensive, xenophobic things about Puerto Rican people, for instance, under the guise of ironic racism. He was able to get away with that for so long until it just gravitated in a direction where he just couldn't get away with it any longer.
Did that early association with Vice give him some credibility as a pundit with other news sources?
I think it did. I think it did for quite some time. And, you know, you look at the friends that he has made, all of whom have been very quick to disassociate themselves with him, you know, since the Proud Boys have sort of established themselves as a far-right extremist group, and especially after the insurrection. He was friends with comedians like, you know, Sarah Silverman, David Cross. You know, he would go on talk shows. He would be interviewed by the Times, you know, as a representative for Vice. He definitely was a guy who, for a while at least, had pretty solid mainstream media credentials as a result of his association with Vice. And I spoke in reporting on this article, I spoke to a guy who is a former Proud Boy and had been on a show repeatedly. And he just talked about Gavin as this very charming, charismatic, funny guy who, you know, if something was blue, he'd say it was yellow. You know, he was contrarian. That's who he was. It was very much baked into his ethos. And I think people viewing him as a contrarian, as somebody who wasn't afraid to say something, you know, offensive or unpopular, I think it really helped him get away with a lot for many, many years.
This is Dante Nero you're talking about, the comedian?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, how did we should say he's a black man, how did he get involved with the Proud Boys? And he was kind of a darling of the Proud Boys community for some time, right?
Yes, in the very early days of the Proud Boys, he was. So to explain that, we should probably talk a little bit about the degrees of initiation into the Proud Boys.
Okay.
So there are various degrees of initiation that range from, you know, getting a tattoo to saying, I am a Western chauvinist and I refuse to apologize for helping to create the modern world, to, you know, one of them is really silly. It's withstanding a beating while yelling out the names of 5 breakfast cereals. And one of these degrees is to abstain from masturbation. The Proud Boys has always promoted the idea that, you know, masturbating... Can I say masturbating on air? I'm assuming I can.
You can't. Maybe once is enough, but yes, you can say it.
Okay. All right. That self-love, let's say, is sort of indicative of a weakening of masculinity. And that was pioneered in large part by Dante Nero, who was this comic who came up with the idea of abstinence and as sort of like a masculinization technique. And part of his brand was sort of establishing himself as a mentor or a guru for men who, very young men in their 20s and 30s, who were struggling with relationships and who needed advice and guidance in that regard. So, and Gavin sort of used, incorporated, you know, the No Wanks philosophy into the Proud Boys, and Dante kind of saw his multiple appearances on Gavin's show as a way to promote his own brand. So it was very much a symbiotic relationship for them, according to Dante, at least for a while.
So initially, McGinnis said he wanted to have something like a drinking club. I don't even know what that means and how he communicated the kinds of people he wanted to meet and have drinks with. But Proud Boys actually did congregate in person in different places in the country, right?
Yes, they did, in New York in the early days.
Okay. And you mentioned that there are some rituals that people can go through to be official members. I mean, is someone in charge of this? Just how structured is the organization?
When I first started reporting this, my understanding was that it was not a very well-structured organization, that it was sort of, you know, there are all these national chapters all over the country, and they don't really report to, you know, a centralized leadership. And they kind of operate according to their own individual bylaws. And I think that's true to a large extent. But I also think that, you know, especially in the past year or so, there has been more of a leadership, a working leadership behind the scenes that is sort of trying to make the group more structured.
Who is Enrique Tarrio?
Enrique Tarrio is the chairman of the Proud Boys. He became the chairman after Gavin McGinnis stepped down in 2018, I believe, following an altercation at the Metropolitan Republican Club in New York City. Enrique is of Afro-Cuban descent. He is from Florida. He's a very charismatic guy. He has sort of adopted the role as the PR organ for the Proud Boys, especially in the months following the attempted insurrection. He's from Roger Stone. He's got sort of the high gloss patina of, you know, GOP connections. Perhaps most importantly, according to experts who study the group, he's a man of color. And he's very public about his identity. And the fact that a man of color is installed in such a leadership position sort of gives the Proud Boys a lot of ammunition to say, hey, look, you know, we have an Afro-Cuban guy as our leader. We're not racist.
Is this like the equivalent of saying I have a black best friend, therefore I'm not racist?
Exactly.
Tarrio, it came to light eventually that he had worked with the FBI or with the federal government as an informant. What do we know about that?
Correct. This was in 2013, 2014, when he was convicted of his involvement in a diabetes test fraud case. And it was reported by Reuters in January, shortly after the insurrection, that he had been working with the government as an informant, which is something that really caused quite a ripple effect within the Proud Boys organization at large.
But no evidence, as far as you've seen it, that he was informing on the Proud Boys in some way?
Not so far, no. Mm-hmm. And Tario, you know, vehemently denies that. But obviously people within the organization harbored their suspicions.
Okay, so was Donald Trump like the Proud Boys' dream president?
He was, absolutely. I mean, they saw it as a rallying moment for them. They saw it sort of as an opportunity for them to bring their ideals to the forefront of the national conversation. I think Gavin McInnes said in Vanity Fair recently that the day of Trump's election was the happiest day of his life. I mean, I think a lot of far-right groups were, you know, saw it as a similar opportunity to gain power and to brand themselves as sort of the new face of the GOP.
Hmm. So being proud of your white heritage can strike some people as pretty obnoxious, but it's not a political agenda. Do they want something from the president of the United States, from Congress? I mean, what are the politics of the Proud Boys?
That's a good question. I mean, I wouldn't say they have a hardcore political agenda. I'm sure they would tell you differently, but I couldn't really discern one. I think it's, you know, far more loosely structured and ideological than that. I think they just feel there's a general sense of anger and a general sense of feeling displaced by, you know, people of color and minorities. And what they want to see is, you know, the primacy of white American masculinity again.
In 2018, you referred to this earlier, Gavin McInnes was invited to speak at the Metropolitan Republican Club in Manhattan. For people who don't remember that story when it broke, what happened at that event?
So basically, you know, at all of these events, there are left-wing protesters that will gather outside and protest the event. And that happened also in this case. And he comes into this club, you know, dressed as a caricature of an Asian person, you know, already being provocative, already being incendiary. It's a reference to a Japanese politician. He's got a katana. And after the event, there is an altercation between a number of members of the Proud Boys and left-wing activists. And two of them were later charged and I believe served jail time as a result of their role in the altercation. And it was caught on camera. I mean, it's very obvious, you know, who provoked what. There was really no ambiguity in this case. But as a result of the bad press surrounding that, and sort of he positioned it as a way to kind of, you know, give the defendant some legal cover, McInnes stepped down from the group.
If the Proud Boys so often act in ways that are openly white supremacist, why is it that they get bothered by being called white supremacists?
That's a good question. I think it was more of an issue in the earlier days of the group, when they were really trying to break into the mainstream, so to speak. I spoke to one former member of Proud Boys leadership who was a lawyer and said that he had a Google alert set up for Proud Boys and terms like white supremacist so that the group could contact all these news organizations that reported on them, and, you know, threaten them with legal action. I think it was a PR maneuver in the early days, honestly, and to a degree still is. I think it was a way to silence people who were attempting to call out the group for what they were and accurately report what they were saying. And I think it was really a way to try to position themselves as a mainstream organization rather than as a far-right extremist group.
At least when they're out in public, the Proud Boys have a pretty distinctive aesthetic. Can you talk about how you could spot one at an event based on their physical appearance?
Sure. So they don't really do this much anymore. They're more on incognito, but they wore these Fred Perry black and yellow polo shirts, which were a skinhead culture thing, you know, years before that they kind of appropriated. And, you know, they're very clean cut. They're, you know, kind of bulky, frat looking. It's kind of like frat boy meets Reagan era like college student meets skinhead, I guess, especially.
Wow, yeah, it's quite a combination. So you said lately they've been tried to be more incognito. I guess they don't want to attract attention before they get done whatever it is they intend to get done at these public events.
Exactly. And it's sort of positioned as a way to, you know, quote unquote, trick Antifa when, you know, they have these inevitable like face downs with anti-fascist protesters at these events.
Were there Proud Boys at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville?
There were a few. Tario was there, although he says he wasn't there for the infamous Tiki Torch rally. And there was a guy named Jason Kessler there who there was later video footage that surfaced that showed him taking the Proud Boy initiation oath, even though McInnes like very strongly condemned him later on his show and condemned the Unite the Right rally in advance, saying it was a trap and that Proud Boy shouldn't go. So like in theory, yes, the Proud Boys were not involved with the Unite the Right rally, but if you look at who was actually at the event and who organized it, there still very much is a Proud Boys hand there.
How much have these guys been on the radar screens of federal law enforcement?
Well, you'd think for quite some time, right? And this was something that I talked about a lot with experts and former law enforcement agents. I mean, a group that is operating so publicly in the open and using violence as a recruitment tool of sorts, you would think they would be on the FBI's radar for some time. But the FBI is very loath to prioritize white supremacists and far-right militant violence within its domestic terrorism program. In fact, there was a report a few years ago that the Proud Boys were going to be designated a terrorist organization by the FBI. And the FBI had to put out a statement saying that it does not and could not police ideology. So really, I mean, in terms of law enforcement, January 6th was really kind of a turning point in how law enforcement treated the Proud Boys in terms of finally starting to officially view them as a threat.
I want to talk for a minute about the treatment that McInnes early on and then the Proud Boys in general got from the media overall. It seems like you discovered that they weren't often called out explicitly for being homophobic, racist, anti-immigrant, Islamophobic. Why do you think they got a pass on these things?
Well, part of it, I think, was the legal threats. You know, part of it was the very aggressive legal tactics that the group was adopting to refute some of the reporting that was being done on them and you know, calling them out for what they were. And part of it, I think, was a real credulity on behalf of the media and a real willingness to believe that they were, in fact, just a drinking club. They were, in fact, just quote unquote, Western chauvinists that, you know, didn't harbor any ill will towards people of different races at all. We're just looking to protect, you know, white male culture. I mean, you look at some of the coverage from them, you know, 2016, 2017, even as late as 2018. And, you know, there are profiles of Gavin McInnes that just sort of depict him as kind of like a lovable contrarian curmudgeon. And I think, you know, certainly his roots as a media mogul certainly played into that. And I also think that the media was just sort of willing to buy what these guys were selling in a lot of ways.
Because they, almost in the same way as Donald Trump, what they say is interesting to the extent that it is shocking to people?
Yeah, I mean, I think they tapped into, you know, a deep-seated anger and resentment, you know, the same type of anger and resentment that Trump tapped into and got him elected with, you know, the dominant strain of left-wing culture. And I think that was part of the allure for media companies, you know, knowing that they drew traffic in that regard. But I also think you can't really underestimate how Gavin McInnes's sort of mainstream media bona fides, you know, even if he had been not associated with Vice for almost a decade at that point, I think they really legitimized the group for quite some time and gave them credence in a way that they otherwise would not have.
Besides being all men and mostly white men, are there other ways to generalize them demographically? I mean, are they college educated? Are they high school educated? Blue collar, white collar? What do you know?
You know, I think they're kind of all over the place. I had sort of come into reporting this under the assumption that they, you know, kind of reflected Trump's voting bloc, that they were largely, well, obviously largely male, largely white male, you know, lower middle class, non-college educated. But I mean, there are definitely Proud Boys who deviate from that template, you know, people of color. I think overall, the thing that really unites the Proud Boys is less demographics and more the resentment that I was referring to earlier, just the feeling that the culture is not going in the right direction and sort of responding to this call to arms that they're issuing to kind of bring the America that they knew back. I think it really is kind of as simple as that.
I've talked to other journalists who have gotten up close to interview like neo-Nazis and Klan members and things like that. And occasionally they'll come back and report that the person that they spent time with is like soft-spoken and polite and didn't seem threatening in the moment, could be charming, which every time I hear those things, they kind of terrify me. But what was your experience when you would call up someone who was an avowed member of the Proud Boys and wanted to talk to them about their beliefs? I mean, but how did they treat you?
It really varied. I would say some of them were the complete opposite of what you describe. You know, were very outwardly belligerent and did not make, you know, any bones about that. And, you know, you always wonder why people are willing to talk to journalists. Especially if they're a member of a group as maligned as the Proud Boys, and especially, and, you know, under legal fire right now as the Proud Boys. And, you know, that question often ran through my mind when I was talking to people who fell in that category, like clearly did not want to be talking to me, but somehow like you had some sort of uncontrollable impulse to do so. even though they mostly just wanted to yell at me. But then you know, when you talk about somebody like Tario, he's exactly what you just described. Like, he's completely the opposite. My impression of him was that he was very soft-spoken, very charismatic. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with ASMR, but like, you know, he kind of has like a very soothing like ASMR voice. And that's his job, you know, like his job is get on the phone and talk to journalists and try to sell his own image of the Proud Boys. And regardless of whether or not that's reflected in actual reality, I mean, he's quite good at it. And I was definitely struck by that when I talked to him. And it was pretty unnerving and spooky, to be honest.
What happened within the group after January 6th when, I mean, certainly the Capitol siege was terrifying and got the attention of the world. They did not succeed in keeping Joe Biden from being certified as the next president. Were there kind of internal tensions after that?
In addition to the arrests, the tension by the arrests? Yeah, I mean, there was the revelation that Tario was an informant, which we've discussed. That was followed by many chapters publicly disavowing him on Telegram, and some former members with more far right extremist explicit leanings coming out and trying to wrest control of the group. So there were initially concerns among people who study far right extremism that the group would become even more explicitly far right than it already is.
Are there people walking away from how far right it is and trying to craft their chapters in a different direction?
Yeah, I mean, I think Tario was really leading the charge in that regard. Something that he spoke to, something that he talked about at length with me and with other reporters covering the Proud Boys, is that he wants to position them as sort of a mainstream political group. You know, he wants to run people for office. He's toying with a run for office. And they've been surprisingly pretty out in the open, you know, for a group that's facing dozens of charges in connection with an attempted insurrection. You know, they were spotted openly rallying in California and Oregon. They even hosted a 4th of July parade in Oregon. They were denied a permit, but they marched anyway. I mean, you'd think that their name had sort of become toxic, but Tario is insistent that he's working on running members for office and trying to get the group mainstream credibility. And when I spoke to him, he said something, I don't think it's in the article, but he said something kind of striking, that, you know, he'd assume about half of GOP supporters are supportive of the Proud Boy cause. And I was like, how do you know this? And he was like, well, because I go to CPAC and I see how many people come up to me and tell me, you know, how proud they are of what we're doing. Now, whether or not that's delusion or not is up for debate, but, you know, certainly his goal is to try to garner the Proud Boys more mainstream credibility.
Did you have the sense that Enrique Tarrio was trying to manipulate your perception of the group, make them seem less menacing?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. I mean, I have, to some extent, I feel that way whenever I interview anybody, regardless of their political affiliation, that mm-hmm. they're sort of trying to manipulate their perspective to get me to align with it more. But definitely when I talk to far-right extremists and people like Tario and members of the Proud Boys, that was definitely his agenda from the second he got on the phone with me, for sure.
Do you think these political ambitions are like his alone and he hopes to use this group as a vehicle, or are they shared by other members of the group?
That's an interesting question. You know, I didn't discuss it with other members of the group. You know, when I talked to them, they were mostly former members. So, you know, they didn't really have any political aspirations to speak of, let alone any goals of harnessing, you know, the association with the Proud Boys to reach any political aspirations. I do think it's, you know, largely his agenda. But I wouldn't be surprised if it was shared by other leaders of the group, although it's unclear how much any of them will be able to actually capitalize on that, considering all the legal trouble that they're in.
What is Gavin McInnes doing now?
He purports to have no affiliation with the Proud Boys, although he, you know, admitted to me that he is still in contact with many of them, and has spoken to other journalists that he still maintains contact with them. He has come out saying, you know, he thought the insurrection was a bad idea. You know, he's come out condemning it. But he also, you know, in the same breath as doing that, has kind of downplayed the extent of the damage that was done. So he's he's still talking about the Proud Boys. He's still using the Proud Boys as part of his brand, even though he's no longer affiliated with the group in name.
So do you have any sense, EJ, of the future that might be in store for this group?
You know, if I were a betting man, if I were a betting man, I would say that they'd probably go the way that a lot of far-right extremist groups do, which is splinter off and sort of go gently into the good night, especially following the events of the insurrection. This is very common. I mean, the far-right groups that people were worried about 4 or 5 years ago after Trump was elected, they're largely non-existent anymore. Like the ones that we talked about going to Unite the Right, they largely don't exist, or at least they don't in their original form. But I think a lot of counterterrorism experts and a lot of people I spoke to would disagree with my opinion. I think that they would think it would be a mistake to discount the Proud Boys at this point and to not take them at their word that they plan on gaining more control, that they plan on becoming more mainstream. And, you know, their argument is people ignored the threat that the Proud Boys posed for years and years, and look what happened. And I think that's certainly, you know, a very sobering but very fair assessment of the situation.
Do you have the sense that they're still recruiting actively online or elsewhere?
I think they're being far more under the radar, but yeah, I mean, I see some of these Telegram threads, and, you know, I know for a fact that at least some of these chapters are. And, you know, like I said earlier, they hosted a 4th of July parade just a few days ago in Oregon, and they didn't get a permit, but, you know, they marched anyway. They are, and they were you know, local politicians who were talking about how they viewed it as an open recruiting attempt. So no, I don't think the Proud Boys story is over by any means. I just think it's a question of how much longer they're going to last in this form.
EJ Dixon covers culture as a staff writer at Rolling Stone, which published her article, The Rise and Fall of the Proud Boys. EJ, thank you for making time to speak with us today.
Thank you so much.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Mia Estrada, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Angelica Perez, Tammy George, and Farissa Green. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.